You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
When we took our trip, we found that on one side of the world, it was bright daylight. And on the other side, it was dark night. Let's see if we can understand this.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 218 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Howard Kasner from Pop Art to discuss a 1987 film that was based on the first of a long-running series of mystery novels that would have 24 entries in the series, starring Donald Sutherland and Charles Durning, directed by Fred Walton. It's The Rosary Murders. But first...
Yet we know that...
The Forgotten Filmcast...
...is regarded as a grave threat to our nation.
For your convenience, we have an attractive snack stand with buttered popcorn, golden good and hot from the popper, sizzling hot dogs cradled in fresh, fluffy buns, ice cream, and other good things to eat.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle. Packed in a jar for the freshest flavor. Served cold in a sack for you to savor. So dainty to eat, no muss, no fuss. An ideal snack for all of us. Crisp, tender, and tasty with a bit of spice. Buy one now. Taste how nice. Snack bar clerks will knock themselves silly, speeding your order for a real Chili Dilly.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
If you liked what Donald Sutherland and Elliot Gould did to the United States Army in MASH, wait till you see what they do to the CIA.
CIA?
As spies.
My career was unblemished until this. Unblemished.
They're brave.
I think you better check it out.
Me?
Yeah.
You check it out.
They're loyal.
Remember last year, the anarchists that blew up the American embassy?
Yeah.
I sold them the dynamite.
They're in top physical condition.
I can't run anymore. We gotta get in somewhere.
I can run for miles. It doesn't bother me.
Oh, yeah? Does this bother you?
Deadly in hand-to-hand combat. They're trained to withstand any torture.
Now talk!
The British think they work for the Russians. The Russians Russians think they work for the Chinese. The Chinese think they work for the anarchists. The anarchists think they work for the Americans, which they do.
Debug the room.
Where do you think this is, the White House?
I think you've been fired.
But I'm up for promotion.
Donald Sutherland and Elliot Gould.
Who did you have in mind? Maybe Elvis Presley and Bo Cronkite?
With spies like these, who needs enemies?
Was just an average American who tried to do the right thing.
If you don't want to get involved, just tell us.
If I can help you, I will.
And then he became a target.
Three.
Because sometimes when a man stands up for what's right,
this is my house,
he has to stand alone.
I am death. Come with me.
Stand Alone, the story of a real American hero. Charles Durning, Pam Grier, Stand Alone, rated R.
Be on your lips and in your heart so that you may rightly and sincerely confess your sins. It's all right. Take your time. There's no hurry.
I'm the one.
Excuse me.
I'm the one.
Oh, my God, I'm really sorry for having been in the muse. I dread the loss of heaven, the pains of hell, but most of you have ever come to thee. Oh, my God. I firmly resolve with the help of thy grace to confess my sins, do my penance, and mend my life. Amen.
Scared, Father.
Yes.
Well, I repent. Will I be in a state of grace when I die, or a state of sin?
I got one in my pocket.
One what?
A rosary.
Why are you doing this?
My daughter died 3 years ago. She was 16 years old. Sweet 16. Pure.
Sorry.
You're sorry. Do you have any idea what it's like to lose a daughter?
No.
It was because of you.
Understand.
All of you.
When you make this a valid confession,
say five Our Fathers and five Hail Marys and cut it out. Is that it?
No, that isn't it. You come here because you want me to stop you, because you want me to help you stop.
I'm not finished. More of you to come. I promise you that.
Please, listen to me. Please, talk to me. Please. Please.
Okay, our movie this time is The Rosary Murders from 1987. And joining me to discuss this film is Howard Kasner from Pop Art. Howard, welcome back to the show.
Oh, great. It's great to be back. Have me on as many times as you want.
Absolutely. It's always great to have you on the show. I feel the same way about your show. I love coming back and guesting on that. But I will let you tell everybody a bit about yourself and your show here before we get started.
Well, as you said, my name is Howard Kasner. I am a script consultant. I've been doing that for about 20 years. I just moved from Los Angeles. I now live right outside Houston. I do have a podcast called Pop Art, and in that, a guest will choose a movie from pop culture, and I'll choose a movie from the more art, indie, foreign side of cinema with a connection to it. And I've been doing that for a few years now. I'm only on 113, I think. I got behind. So if you look, you'll see there's been a big bit of time before the last two were put up. I just put up the one with Richard Kirkham, who we both know from the Lamb cast, the Valentine's Day episode of Ghost. And don't tell me, I know what the other one is. Truly, Madly, Deeply.
Yeah.
I suppose I should also put a shout out that I have two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are sci-fi, fantasy, horror short stories. And I also have a book, my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader. I think that is everything. Did I forget anything?
I don't think so. Actually, there is one thing that I'll just throw out that I appreciate about you. You know, we've known each other for many years and we're friends on Facebook. And I love seeing your photos. You're quite the photographer. And I've always had an interest in photography myself. It's something that when I was a kid, I started just very early, you know, kind of family members encouraged me to do that. I remember my first camera was actually a Spider-Man camera. So it had all kinds of like Marvel logos and things like that on there, but it was an actual camera. And I took that thing everywhere and took pictures. And I've just always had an interest in taking pictures and seeing other people, you know, kind of express themselves through that medium. So it's always a lot of fun to see your photographs on Facebook, because I mean, it's not even just capturing extraordinary things. You do a lot of interesting photos of just everyday things that, you know, we'd pass by and maybe not look twice about, but you've got a great eye and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah. The photographs I'm working on now are of my visit to Sydney and then a cruise to New Zealand, and like everything, I'm way behind. But as you say, the last thing I uploaded was a photograph of the lifeboats. Did it in black and white. So,
Now, are you doing things digitally primarily, or are you one of those folks that's still like, you know, must use film or, you know,
these are on my phone. And what made it more exciting for me is that once you upload them to Instagram or something, you can play with them.
Oh yeah. It's great.
So that's what really got me into it. But it's all on my phone.
I can remember, you know, back when I was in college, I was a communications major, and, you know, there's certain courses that you had to take, those core courses. And back at this time, which was the early 90s, you still had to take a photography course. And by that actually meant photography using film. And we learned how to develop film and go into the dark room. And, you know, we had to do things with, you know, like blocking out certain areas of the photo or highlighting certain things, you know, all kinds of stuff that you do with a couple of clicks now. But we were doing it like holding sheets of paper in front of the the machine as we were capturing the photo, and then going and develop it and stuff. And, you know, all the chemicals stank like crazy and all that. I mean, it was fun and interesting, but it's great to have a much easier way of doing that nowadays.
That is for sure.
And I'm not even, you know, terribly skilled when it comes to Photoshop and things like that. I mean, that's my wife's department. My wife was, you know, worked as a desktop publishing for many years and did a lot of image manipulation. So she's much better than that. But I'm the one that likes to actually take the pictures. Now, getting back to the movies, though, one of the things that's great about your show is that you do cover a wide variety of different things where, you know, like you said, kind of your guest grabs onto a pop culture thing. You come back with something that's a bit more artistic or maybe a foreign film or things like that. I'm always a little bit nervous when I get invited on your show because I'm like, you know, is Howard going to pick something that's going to be like hard for me to find? It's going to be from some country that you know, you can't just pull up their movies that easily or stuff. I mean, do you find it a challenge sometimes where your guests are maybe like, oh, I don't even know where to begin to look for that movie that you've suggested?
Well, usually I check and make sure that it's available on Amazon, at least. Mm-hmm. At other times, it might be available in other things. A lot of people I know have Criterion, so
yeah.
That I did mess up, I think, recently. It wasn't with you, was it? My memory is so bad. The Verne chose May, December, and I chose this movie, Memories of Murder, I think is what it was called. Anyway, the premise was that in both cases, you have an actress who is doing a role, and she goes and finds someone similar to that character in order to help her with that role. And of course, May, December is based on the Marianne Letourneau or whoever that person was.
Right. Yeah.
And I chose this Greek film, though half of it is in English, with Ellen Burstyn and Milena McCurry, about someone, Milena McCurry playing Medea. And she goes, finds this person, Ellen Burstyn, who's in jail for killing her children. And at the time when I said it was on YouTube, so I told them, well, it's on YouTube, no problem. And then when I rewatched it, none of the Greek was subtitled. And so there were some moments when you're sort of going, now what's going on here? But usually I'm much more careful than that. Usually I make sure that the person can find it before we agree on it. I also ask someone to, you know, ask you to give me two or three. So, you know, in case something's not, there have been times when some people have suggested even two and I go, they're just not available anywhere.
Yeah.
So yeah. You have to choose more.
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's the thing too about, like, you know, well, not even just YouTube, but any streaming service. I mean, sometimes it's there one day and the next day it's gone. I had one episode not all that long ago that we were planning on a certain movie. And, you know, it just a couple of days before we recorded disappeared. And I was like, oh no, what am I going to do? How am I going to watch this film? We figured out a solution, but yeah, it's a challenge sometimes. That's why, you know, physical media is a good way to go with things for sure.
That happened to me once before too. And all of a sudden it's a week before and I'm going, I swore this movie was available. So we had to, I think, choose another movie.
Well, before we get on to this movie, one of the things often when we talk, I know you've brought up kind of what areas of film are kind of most exciting to you at a given moment. I know at different times when we've had you on the show, you've talked about cinema from different countries really excelling at a certain time or certain themes in movies that you're really excited about. So what about, you know, movies in 2024 right now? What are the things that are getting you excited?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that it is. I think we're at this crossroads. I even put a Facebook posting up today, and I think we're changing aesthetics. And I think we've reached a stagnant where there's not enough forward momentum, which is why we're having trouble producing a new set of directors, a new set of movies that are interesting and such. And what we talked about on the Facebook posting was this new thing called metamodernism, which, if that really does take hold, that is probably going to be the future. And basically, that takes the aesthetics and stylistic approach of postmodernism, but combines them with the morality and theme of modernism. I think still the most exciting countries making films is still South Korea and Romania. When they broke through, both of them, that was just incredible. But France constantly comes up with a new set of directors and filmmakers every so often. They somehow just seem to be able to keep that shuffling. Italy has a bit more problem with that, but they still are able to do that. So what is exciting? I mean, most people think horror is where it's at. And I sort of agree. Horror is where it's at. If you come up with a low-budget original horror idea, you've got it made. And we have so many out there. We have so much. Most of it's crap, and most movies are crap. But then you'll get these very original ones. Same with sci-fi right now. So I don't know. Does that answer the question?
Well, yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting you mentioned horror, too, just because, you know, a lot of times when I hear people starting to talk about like horror movies that they're getting excited about are these things that are showing up as like originals on Shudder and things like that. And, you know, I think, you know, maybe having streaming services like that, that are focused on a certain genre, is fueling that somewhat. You know, they need content, and folks are getting the opportunities to put some, you know, maybe more original, more out there ideas, on film and have someone actually show it. And that might be part of the reason that some interesting things are being created.
Yeah, it's also probably the cheapest genre to make. The problem is that it's a dead end as a filmmaker. You can only go so far making horror films, and you have to redefine yourself at some point, and that's not easy to do. We have a couple that are doing it. The person who did Hereditary, the person who did The Witch, the person who did It Follows, are doing their best to break through and break out and get away from that sort of thing. But it's difficult. Once you're stuck in a certain genre sometimes, it can be very difficult to get out of it.
Well, that sounds like a segue if there ever was one, because the movie we're talking about today is from a guy that kind of made his mark first in the horror arena. So let's get going with this movie. Like I said, it's called The Rosary Murders. It's from 1987, directed by a guy named Fred Walton. And he only directed a handful of theatrical films, but the one that kind of started it for him is pretty well known, and that is 1979's When a Stranger Calls. He also directed another horror film that we've talked about on a previous episode of this show going way, way back. He directed 1986's April Fool's Day, which I thought was a pretty clever and original horror film there. But beyond a handful of theatrical films, he's mainly known for directing television. This includes some episodes of shows like Miami Vice and Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And then he did a number of TV movies, including the sequel to his own film, When a Stranger Calls Back. And he also did The Stepford Husbands, which I got to admit, I did not realize there was a Stepford Husbands, but I guess there might as well.
I do have to say, when a Stranger Calls Back is a far better film than it has any right to be. And it's actually rather entertaining. If I got it right, Criterion had it as part of their 1980s horror thing when they covered it, or it was 1990s or whatever. And, you know, I watched it and I said, oh, this is actually kind of interesting. You know, I'm not saying it's all, you know, that successful necessarily or that good, but it's far better than it has any right to be.
Well, this film, it's based on a novel, also called The Rosary Murders, written by William X. Kinsey. And he himself is, I'm sure, not that unlike the lead character in this film. He was a former priest turned author, and this was the first of his Robert Kessler mystery novels, which I guess became a long-running series. There were 24 entries in this series going between 1978 and 2002. Now, when we talk about the writing here, though, we also should mention that the screenplay not only had Kinsey involved in it, as well as the director of the film, but there was an assist by none other than Elmore Leonard on the screenplay for this film. Now, the movie takes place in Detroit, Michigan, which is where the author was a priest himself. So again, he's kind of drawing from what he knows here, I guess. But it starts off with the mysterious death of a priest who is in the hospital on Ash Wednesday. He's on some kind of a breathing machine or life support thing of some sort, and it gets unplugged, and the nurse discovers it, and this priest passes away. A short time later, we have a young nun who is found dead in her bathtub by priest Robert Kessler, played by Donald Sutherland. And this is shortly after this nun has told Kessler that she is going to leave the sisterhood and then marry a man that she's fallen in love with. Now, Kessler is then approached by a journalist named Pat Lennon, played by Belinda Bauer, who is investigating these two murders. It seems that both of the victims were found with an unusual black rosary that was not their own. And so, you know, they start to realize, okay, there's some connections here. And eventually more murders start to happen. This, of course, is concerning to the whole Catholic community, especially Kessler and his fellow priest, Father Ted Neighbors, played by Charles Durning. Now, things get especially difficult for Kessler, though, because he's doing confession one day and a person comes in, is on the other side of the screen there, and basically confesses that he is the killer and that he is not done. And in the process of this, the man also gives him some information that could identify who he is, but Kessler is conflicted because he can't break the seal of confession and tell the police what he knows. So Kessler soon realizes that the only way that he can hope to save others is to try and find out who the killer is himself. And this leads him down a dark path as he tries to discover the identity of the killer and where he will strike next. Now, I remember seeing ads in the newspaper for this one back in the 80s when it came out, but it was one of those movies that came and went from the theaters very quickly. But I'm going to let Howard get us started here. Give us a few of your thoughts on The Rosary Murders.
I can't remember exactly where I saw it. I bet it was on television. And it fit a few slots that I liked. One is that these people are all have a connection. You know, they're all being killed. It's a serial killing. But there is a very, very specific connection as to why they're being killed. A reason, not so much connection as a reason. Mm-hmm. And it's like the movies like And Then There Were None, Seven, The Abominable Dr. Fives, Theater of Blood. And I like those films because, first of all, you have to figure out why he's killing the people he is, but also the method that he uses and how he's doing it and how it connects to the background as why he's doing it. Like, And Then There Were None, you know, you get a vague idea of how everybody's going to die, but then you're just watching them go one by one, trying to figure out who's going to be the next one and what does the nursery rhyme mean when it comes to them dying. So I like the mystery as a whole. I think there's some issues with the resolution and some issues with the logic of it. But I found the mystery to be very interesting. But I think there are two reasons why this movie is really worth watching. I mean, some of the dialogue is very witty. And I don't know whether to give that to Elmer Leonard or the original book. But Donald Sutherland is great in this. But I always feel like Donald Sutherland is one of those actors who is great no matter what piece of crap he's in.
Yeah.
And I think this is a great performance by him. And then there's Charles Durning, and he is really good in this as well. Everybody else is kind of fine. You know, that's, you know, they're whatever. But it's these two actors that really, I think, carry this movie. I like film noir. It's my favorite genre from the 40s and 50s. And so I tend to like neo-noir, post-noir. I don't like crime drama all that much, but I do like mysteries. You know, someone's killing, you know, who killed so-and-so and why and what's the solution to the problem. So I think, you know, that's what drew me to it. That's why I liked it. I think seeing a second time, it holds up as entertainment. It moves really fast. It gets itself going. It doesn't linger. And as I said, there are just some issues, I think, with the resolution and why the person is killing some of the people.
Right.
It's very clear why he kills two of them. But then it gets a little murky as to why he kills the others.
I would definitely agree with that. And, you know, we will get to that stuff eventually. Folks that listen to this show know that we don't shy away from spoilers on this film. But we will wait a little bit and throw up a spoiler warning before we dig into that. But, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that Sutherland and Durning are two of the big reasons to watch this. And I want to dig into their performances more in a bit here as well. But this was my first time ever seeing it. I mean, like I said, I'd been aware of it, but just never gotten around to it. And I thought this was a really intriguing little movie. I am not terribly big on mysteries. I do enjoy watching them, but in a lot of ways, mystery movies, I've said this on the show many times, mystery movies make me feel a little dumb sometimes because I very rarely figure them out as I'm watching them. My wife is much quicker about that kind of thing. She reads mysteries all the time. And so we'll go see a mystery or something like that. And then she'll be like, well, yeah, I figured it out 45 minutes in. And I'm like, well, of course you did. It took me the whole movie. You know, I'm just not wired that way. But I do still find them intriguing. And this one, I think, is really interesting. I mean, it has some interesting concepts to it. It's a pretty simple little mystery, but it does deal with some interesting themes when it comes to the idea of our main character being a priest. And we kind of see him struggling with kind of the, you know, what he should be doing in the eyes of the world versus what he should be doing in the eyes of the church, and, you know, how he feels like he needs to respond to these different situations. I mean, it definitely makes you think. And it's a very kind of quiet and subtle movie. I mean, for a movie that is ultimately about a serial killer, there's nothing flashy about this movie. It doesn't, you know, kind of dwell in the gruesomeness or anything like that. It plays out in just a very kind of simple and subtle way. And I thought that was kind of refreshing.
I agree. It is what it is. And it's directed that way. And it's very well directed from that perspective. There is no flashiness. It's a story simply told, and I think that's very, very true. One of the things I like about Donald Sutherland is his character. His character likes being a priest. Mm-hmm. He really likes it. It's sort of his calling, and he's not, you know, torn or conflicted inside about it. He's sort of conflicted about the confession, but not about being a priest. He really likes being a priest, and he's very good at it. He is a really good priest. So it is interesting that though this is in some ways an attack on the Catholic Church, in another way it's not, because the central character, the father, is a really a good person. So I think that's also an interesting aspect of it. When it comes to Charles Durning, he's very good, but you sort of say, yeah, well, you know, if the killer gets him,
Well, there's definitely a contrast between the two characters. I mean, you're right. I mean, one of the things that comes through in a big way in this movie is it makes Donald Sutherland's character especially a real person. I mean, too often in movies, I think that, you know, when it comes to portrayals of priests or nuns, there's this kind of, I don't know, this caricature. There's this way that we see them in movies that is maybe a little bit cartoonish, and they don't even feel like real people. And here, Donald Sutherland's character comes across as a very relatable, just a down-to-earth, real guy. I mean, we don't see him walking around all the time wearing the collar and all that stuff. I mean, you know, one of the earliest scenes of the movie, he's lounging around in sweats and all that stuff and just, you know, looks like, you know, your next door neighbor type of a thing. And the way that he relates to people, you know, he does so in a very down to earth way. Charles Durning's character, on the other hand, I think he's very believable, but he's the more dogmatic character. He's the one that's more wrapped up in, well, this is the way it is. This is the way the church says it has to be. And more importantly, this is the way I say it's supposed to be. And don't you go against me, because I'm going to make you sorry for it.
Exactly. And he does go against him in some ways. But it is interesting when Donald Sutherland, his character, of course, it is based on probably, I mean, the person who wrote it was a priest when he wrote it.
Right.
So that's probably, and he was someone who worked for the diocese paper. So that probably is one of the reasons why this is such a much more realistic look at someone who is a priest. But there is this wonderful scene where Donald Sutherland goes to his superior and say, what if I know that the communion wine has been poisoned? Someone told me that in confession. And what do I do? And the person says, you got to let the people die. Mm-hmm. Until he finally says, well, you better find a way to spill the communion wine without anybody knowing.
Yeah, yeah. that's ultimately what the movie, you know, the course that the movie follows is this is his way of spilling the wine.
Yeah, even at the end, the guy says, you violated the confessional, and Donald Sutherland says, no, I didn't. And he didn't. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, there might be an argument either way for that. But he never told anybody.
Yeah. That scene where he talks to the other priest, and it's not Charles Durning's character. This is a different priest. I thought that scene was a great example of how Donald Sutherland in this film is doing a lot by doing a little.
Right.
You know, it's not a terribly overdramatic sequence, anything like that. But you kind of see the wheels turning behind his eyes, the things that he's trying to think through to try and, you know, get him out of this dilemma that he's in. You know, just the fact that the scene starts, so he's sitting there on the steps while there's a gathering going on in the room behind him, and he's out there alone, and he's sitting on the steps, and he's got his head resting against the banister because he's just, you know, filled with this conflict. He doesn't know what to do about it. And I thought, that just feels so honest, such an honest portrayal of the emotions that he'd be going through. And he's not doing it by spilling a bunch of words and telling you in all this flowery talk the conflict that's going on here. It's the way that you or I might try to reason our way out of a situation. And I thought, well, this is great.
Yes. There's just something about him. As I say, I'm a big admirer of Donald Sutherland. I think he's been underrated. Whenever I see him in a film, no matter how small the role, no matter how big the role, he's always great. He finally got an honorary. He's never got an Oscar nomination, but he finally got an honorary Oscar after he became relevant again because he was in the Hunger Games. So he became a relevant actor again. So they finally gave an honorary Oscar, something they should have given him before. He came close a couple of times to getting an Oscar nomination. One was for Prefontaine and the other one was for Pride and Prejudice, but it just never seemed to happen. But he's always been a very subtle actor. You see him in Clute, you know, he's very subtle there, but he's really, really good. And he goes back a long way. Yeah, you know, you see him in The Avengers, you see him, the one film that I understand really helped change his career was this omnibus film, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. Mm-hmm. And he's in the vampire episode. And I remember he made I was only like, 12, 13, 14 when I saw that. And I even remember now that he made a big impression on me when I saw that he was doing this horror film, but he was so real. Yeah, I've just always been a huge, huge admirer of him. I think he's better than Elliot Gould in MASH. I think he's,
Well, I was going to say, I mean, where I think I first became aware of him was MASH. And, you know, I'm someone who, you know, my exposure to MASH initially, of course, was the TV series. My father watched that every week. And so when I finally saw the movie, when I was probably like a senior in high school or something like that, and I see Donald Sutherland's take on this character that I, you know, grew up watching Alan Alda do, and I was like, oh, I so much more appreciate Donald Sutherland's take on that character than Alan Alda's, you know, just so much going on there. But one of the things too that I found really interesting about this character and kind of the way that this movie is structured, I mean, going into it, kind of seeing the brief synopsis and such, I thought, okay, well, this is like an amateur sleuth movie. You know, it's one of those where you've got somebody, you know, whatever their occupation is for real, in this case, it's a priest, and they are thrown into this mystery and they're the one that's solving the crime. You know, I mean, you know, think like Murder, She Wrote, you know, I mean, because Murder, She Wrote, it's the type of thing where it's like, okay, you know, people love that show. I get it. But, you know, that this little old lady, you know, just is always out there solving murders. It you know, she's not a detective or whatever. She's just, you know,
she writes crime novels.
Yeah. And she's always in the wrong place, you know. So,
well, it got to a point where I'm telling people never go any place where that character is going because somebody's going to get killed.
Exactly.
And it might be you.
Yeah.
But that's also true of Miss Markle and Hercule Poirot. They always seem, wherever they go, someone gets killed. Mm-hmm. And that's just so very, very true. And of course, there's a huge number of Kessler novels where he solves mysteries. You know, there's a series called The Rabbi that has a rabbi solving mysteries, and which I love. I really love it there. And, but you're going, this is a lot of murders for one person. It's not like you're a private detective or a police detective who would see murders all the time.
And I always found that to be a bit of a stretch, you know, that, you know, just that we're supposed to believe that this person who is in actuality a writer or a priest or whatever is going to spend all their time solving murders. And going into this movie, I thought, okay, well, this is that type of thing. This is, you know, the priest is going to go and solve the murder. It's really not that, though. He's not going into this with any ambition about being a detective. You know, he's trying to get himself out of this hole that he's got. You know, the struggle between what his faith tells him that he should do, or what his role as a priest tells him that is he should do, versus what he feels like he should just do as a good person. And so, you know, I found that to be a really interesting take on that kind of amateur sleuth genre.
Well, in this case, yes. The only reason why he's trying to find the murderer and solve it is because he can't tell anybody about it. He would tell the police and give them all this information if he could, but he can't. So the only way to stop this guy from killing is to try to figure out why and who he's going after and be there first to stop him. So that is true. It's not like, I'm Father Brown, so I'm going to solve this mystery. Mm-hmm. It's like, I've got to solve this mystery because this guy has confessed to me and I can't tell anybody about it. So if I'm going to stop him from killing again, I have to try and figure out who he is and who he's going to kill.
Well, speaking of that, let's talk a bit about the murders in this. One thing you kind of talked about earlier was the idea of the killer kind of having a certain method to their madness, the way that they kill people. And one of the things that I thought was interesting here is that the killer doesn't stick to one method in this one. You know, it's not like, you know, where we have a killer that's always killing with a bow and arrow or whatever. This is always different depending on who the victim is.
Yes. I mean, he does tend to use the gun a few times, but what connects the people is, well, I guess we can reveal it. We're in spoiler territory.
I think, we can go ahead and say what connects them here.
He realizes that each one of their names relates to one of the Ten Commandments. And so he's killing off these people in accordance with the Ten Commandments. The problem that I had with this time is that only two people had a direct connection to why this person is killing people.
Right.
And that's, you know, what's his name?
Charles Durning.
Yes, Charles Durning. And then a nun who has taken a vow of silence because of this. The other eight, it's not dramatized as if they had any part in this at all. So basically, I guess he noticed that the priest and Charles Durning's name happened to correspond to two of the commandments. And he went, okay, now I'll find eight others that correspond to it. And I'll call them along with, I'm going, wait a minute, that's not really, there's something off about that. I mean, he is sort of trying to make a larger statement about how the Catholic Church didn't do anything to stop him when they should have. But, you know, it's interesting. It's not like the abominable Dr. Fimes, where he's killing everybody that's connected with his wife's operation, and he's doing it according to the plagues of Egypt, or Theater of Blood, where he's killing all the critics who didn't give him an award one year, and he's killing them according to the Shakespeare plays that he did that year, or Seven, where he's doing it according to the the seven deadly sins. Though I think that is also weak like this. I think by the time at the end when it's resolved, I think they had an issue the same as here. And then there were none where people have been chosen and invited to this island because they are responsible for killing somebody. And this person gathered them together to kill them one by one. So, but this idea that it seems like there's a connection, but there's only a connection in that each one corresponds to the Ten Commandments. Outside of that, there's no other connection. And that does seem a little strange.
It's a stretch. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's one of those kind of reveals where you're like, all right, that's interesting. That's kind of clever. But then the more you start to process it, you're kind of going, well, what are the odds that there are 10 people, all of the Catholic Church in Detroit, Michigan, that have names that you can tie to one of the Ten Commandments? And, you know,
I think it would probably be very easy because Detroit is a huge Catholic town. But it's just that the two victims that he really wanted happen to have names,
right,
that correspond with the Ten Commandments. That's the big coincidence.
Yeah.
Other than that, you just get out a directory and you just go down and you'll find somebody. And even for one of them, he has to go marry Magdalene to stand in for adultery. So it's not like someone was, you know, was not named Mary Adultery or anything. So he did have to stretch it a bit. But you're right. It's just really kind of an odd way for a serial killer to act. There's also no real explanation as to why he waited so long to do it. I mean, I could be wrong, but the timeline isn't clear to me as when the daughter committed suicide.
I think one of the things I saw indicated that it was about 3 years, which...
Exactly. So yeah. Why is he waiting 3 years? If it happened that year and he waited until Ash Wednesday, which is when this whole thing starts, that makes sense. But 3 years ago, why is he suddenly doing it now? And that doesn't quite make sense. There's no explanation as to what's happened in his life that made him decide, oh, I'm going to go after these people now.
Well, I mean, there's clearly some things, too, that aren't right up in his head. I mean, one of the things we didn't talk about was kind of the other things that moves this whole thing forward. And it's the idea that our killer is the father of a 16-year-old girl who committed suicide. And the reason that she committed suicide, though, was because he was involved in incest with her, basically, to put it simply. And she goes to the, the nun and, tells her about this. And the nun says, you're lying. Why would you say this about your father and that? And he even goes for confession with Durning's character, Father Neighbors, because we got to tie it into, don't covet your neighbor's things there, but he confesses to Durning's character. And, the thing that he says is, oh, I'll do five Hail Marys and quit it, whatever. Right. And so it's like he's angry at the church because they didn't stop him.
Right.
And it's kind of like, but you still did that terrible thing, so, yeah, something's not right.
Well, yeah, no, there's something off about this. It's also kind of interesting that this took place long before the big scandals happened with pedophilia and things like that in the
right,
church.
Yeah. The book is 78 and the movie's 87. So, yeah.
Yeah. So this was something new to introduce into it, something rather scandalous. But, yeah, I mean, it just to say, well, just don't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, before we start kind of wrapping things up here, I want to give it a chance, like any kind of standout moments in the film for you here. I mean, we kind of said this is kind of a quiet film for what it's about. We don't have as many kind of gruesome moments or things like that. But I guess what are some of the scenes that really, really work for you?
Well, we mentioned one, of course, where he talks to his mentor about what should he do. There are a couple of scenes that kind of amuse me. One where he meets the detective, the police detective in the bar. And the detective says, do you want a drink? And he says, yeah, sure. What are you having? He's having a virgin Mary, and he says, I'll have that too.
Yeah.
So he's willing to either drink or not drink. He's just there to sort of, I don't know exactly how to explain why that sort of worked for me, but I just thought it was funny. Okay, then I won't drink if you're not going to drink. The scene at the funeral where Charles Durning takes the eyeglasses and Father Kessler says, well, I hear he got a new set of dentures.
Yes.
As yeah. well. I did like the scene where, but this is also a little fault in the movie, where he and the reporter, you know, when he says, let's go do something. Let's just go do something. And the reporter says, like a date. And he says, yeah, like a date. Mm-hmm. And it cuts to the next morning. And I'm going, did something happen?
Right.
I mean,
right.
What did they do? And it's very vague, you know, what went on there. I also want to point out Lupe Ontiveros is in this movie. She played the housekeeper who takes care of the rectory where the priests live. She became popular for Real Woman Have Curves, Chuck and Buck, and some things like that. But yeah, I think those are, they're small moments. As you said, they're very small moments. But there was something about them that just stood out for me. The other thing at the end that I questioned was when Charles Durning is saying, okay, well, he's just here for confession. I don't need you. He wants to do this. He wants to arrange something from his daughter who committed suicide. And he lets him in without questioning. And I'm going, they haven't found the killer, you idiot.
Right, right. And this is after the whole big incident in the, what was it, the Good Friday service, I think,
yes,
where,
Good
you know,
Friday.
Where they think, you know, that Durning's the target. And, you know, there's a whole incident where one of the altar boys drops the cross and the cops all pounce because they think it's a gunshot and all that. That was another fun sequence that had kind of an unexpected little humorous side to it.
There's Donald Sutherland who's trying to tell him, don't see this guy, but he can't say don't see this guy.
Yeah.
Because if he does, he'll violate the confession. And Durning keeps telling, you know, you don't have to be here. Go away, go away. And I'm like, first of all, since the murder hasn't been found, I'm not sure you're going to tell them to go away, because this guy could be the murderer. But yeah, Donald Sutherland is there not going away, trying not to go away, you know. So I thought that was an interesting little scene, in spite of the fact that I do question it.
I want to jump back to what you were saying about kind of the relationship between Donald Sutherland and the female reporter, which, you know, was another kind of interesting aspect of this film where, you know, you kind of see Sutherland's character kind of struggling with, you know, what he should do in different situations and, you know, what is expected of him as a priest and all that kind of stuff. I mean, she clearly is attracted to him. And I think that you can sense that he is attracted to her as well. And so it's kind of interesting, though, you know, kind of going back to that other scene you were talking about where he says how, well, you know, I always wanted to be a priest. And you know, he, you know, clearly that is what his calling is. But there's still some struggle there, some conflict. And you know, I thought that's something that came across in a very genuine way. I mean, too often when we see that kind of struggle in a priest character in a movie, it's, you know, it gets pretty extreme pretty quickly. You know, I thought the way that was portrayed here was pretty genuine.
He has this way of relating to women without being threatening.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mean, you even get the concept earlier in the movie where he has that scene with the nun who is, you know, about to become a victim herself. And she says she's leaving the sisterhood. She's met this man and she's going to marry him. And you kind of get the impression like, yeah, he may, you know, maybe in a different world that he might have been in a relationship with her, that he kind of sees her in that way.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
One of the scenes, too, I wanted to mention here that I really enjoyed was the scene where he is questioning the nun who has taken the vow of silence.
Yes.
And, you know, it's done in the confessional, and which several scenes are done in the confessional here as well, which I found that to be just really interesting, the way they handled those. You know, the idea that we can only see the priest. We don't see the other person. It's, you know, shadowy. It's creepy. You know, that I thought it was done very effectively, but especially that scene with the nun where she's taken a vow of silence. So she's scribbling her answers on little pieces of paper. And, you know, we see Sutherland, he's asking questions. We hear the little sound of the pencil on the paper and that, and she shoves the responses under. And again, just seeing the way that Sutherland kind of builds the tension in there, you see him getting frustrated with it because she's just giving these short answers that aren't giving him information. And he's getting more and more frustrated with it. I thought it was a really effective scene.
Well, I agree. Yeah, I think so. But it reminded me of another scene, and that is the very first scene when the killer comes to confess to him. When Donald Sutherland realizes that it's this person, he thinks he might die. So he starts praying the prayer of contrition in case he gets shot, in case he dies like the others. And I thought that was also a really interesting scene. The scenes in the confessional were very good. Yes. There's an authenticity to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a word I would use to describe the whole movie. I thought there was an authenticity to this movie. It's one where I felt like this is not, you know, one of those kind of, I don't know, like we said, that amateur sleuth type of thing where we're kind of bending over backwards to reach certain things. Yes, there are some things that are a bit of a stretch here, but I thought this was a movie that was very grounded, felt very real, gave me an interesting picture of this world, you know, the Catholic Church, not something that I'm terribly familiar with. You know, the characters were all very interesting and, you know, led by two great performances there with Sutherland and Durning. I mean, especially Sutherland. I think if you're at all interested in him as an actor and, you know, kind of want to check out everything he's done, this is a movie that does not get talked about very much. And he delivers a really, really good performance.
I agree. As you say, it's a forgotten film, maybe.
Well, that's why we talk about it here, for sure. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another one of our podcasting friends, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
Hello, everyone. This is JD from the In Session Film Podcast. Each week, we review
the latest from Hollywood, California.
Well, yes, Brendan. We also
give top three lists.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks again, Brendan. Additionally, you can hear us
talk other movie news, trailers, varying movie series, or other interesting film-related topics, and even rants and raves of the week.
That's correct, Brendan. On top of our main show, every Friday,
you can also hear our extra film podcasts.
Good job, Brendan.
Thank you, JD. It's my goal to make you proud. You're the father, after all.
Yes, and I'm very proud. You can listen to the In Session Film podcast on
iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or at InSessionFilm.com.
Brendan, will you please let me complete just one?
Nope.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Listen to the In Session Film podcast every Monday and Friday. Subscribe today and hear me verbally beat JD like a Cherokee drum.
No. That's not how this works, sir.
Hey,
no.
Go cry at Midnight Special again, okay? That's what you're good for.
I will. You know what? And I'll do it while pummeling you. I'll do both at the same time.
How are you going to pummel me? Yeah, I don't buy it.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support this show and earn access to some bonus features, including a bunch of the old episodes of this show, which are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more, and we thank you for your support.
What was it about the 90s that made movies so much better? How much of an impact did they make during that decade? And while we're at it, can we throw around some 90s slang? Join me, Jason Soto, a lover of all things 90s, as I do a deep dive into cinema from the best era ever. Rabbit Hole Podcasts present That's the Bomb, Yo! 90 Hella Rad Movies from the 90s. You can find this show on Anchor, Apple, Google, anywhere you get podcasts from, or its home location at rabbitholepodcasts.com. And who knows, maybe even Alicia Silverstone will finally accept my date.
Oh, I'm in!
Gym Rex? What's Gym Rex?
Would you believe a movie audience guide presented as a public service by this theater's management to help you select your motion picture entertainment? Well, that's what it is. And we urge you to learn these rating symbols and use them as a guide for you and your family. G means suggested for general audiences, all ages. M, suggested for mature audiences, parental discretion advised. R, restricted, persons under 16 not admitted unless accompanied by parent or adult guardian. X, persons under 16 will not be admitted. This seal in advertising indicates that the film was approved under the Motion Picture Code of Self-Regulation.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk a bit about another movie that we've enjoyed that we would like everybody else to check out. It might be a forgotten film. It might be an old classic or something that's new in theaters or on streaming. It could be anything. So, Howard, what is your recommendation?
I wanted a film that connected to this film in some way, and there were several ways I could go. So I think I finally settled on something with a similar idea, and that's I Confess, the Alfred Hitchcock film with Montgomery Clift.
Yes.
He plays a Catholic priest, and there's a murder, and the murderer comes to him and confesses to him, comes to the confessional. There's a little question here, because the German immigrant who confesses apparently isn't Catholic, but that doesn't really matter. You still can't reveal anything from the confessional. So Montgomery Clift's character doesn't quite know what to do. The problem is, it's a Hitchcock film. So Father Logan, Montgomery Clift, gets accused of the murder himself, and he can't reveal who the real murderer is to clear himself. What's kind of interesting is the original ending that Hitchcock wanted is that he actually is executed for the crime. And a lot of people think that it was the Catholic Church who stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. But actually, the Catholic Church said, no, this is fine, because from their perspective, this is exactly what a priest should do. They should martyr themselves in cases like this. It was the studio. And the studio said, no, that's too downer of an ending. So things work out. But it's not one of Hitchcock's best films. There is a radio. Alfred Hitchcock did some of his films on radio, and I Confess was one, and Cary Grant played the part. It's very funny, because all Cary Grant seems to be saying throughout is yes, no, yes, no. It gets to be kind of funny. But Cary Grant would have been great in this role, but it went to Montgomery Clift instead.
It's a good pick. I mean, this is one that I had not seen in terms of my Hitchcock viewing. I haven't seen all of them, but, you know, I've seen, you know, the ones that, you know, everybody says are the must-sees and all that. And I was starting to work my way through other ones. And I'm pretty sure, I think I ended up watching this because, you know, every now and then the previously mentioned Criterion Channel will do a Hitchcock thing. And I'm pretty sure I ended up seeing this on Criterion Channel and enjoyed it quite a bit. You know, I mean, it's beyond Montgomery Clift. I mean, you've got like Ann Baxter in there, Carl Malden, who, you know, Carl Malden is one of those people that, you know, like we were saying about Donald Sutherland or Charles Durning, is someone that, you know, I kind of want to watch just about everything he's in. You know, he's just one of those guys that grabs me. Good film. And what you're saying about the radio dramas, this is something that I know was done quite a bit back in the day, where the studios would produce a radio version of their movies. And I know, you know, in times where I've like been kind of on a old radio kick, or, you know, listening to those stations that play old radio shows, I've heard a number of these where they're radio drama versions of these films that we all know and love, or in some cases are films we've forgotten about. And it's really interesting to listen to those different takes on those films.
Well, yeah, it can be interesting to see what they have to do to get it down into like 50 minutes. Like,
right.
Rebecca, the brother, I mean, the sister and brother-in-law, they're gone. They're not in the movie at all. One of my funniest experiences with that was Lux Radio Theater is one of the big ones that did it at the time.
Right.
And so I can't remember which movie it was that I was listening to, but it starts off with Cecil B. DeMille, who was the producer of this, saying, we were supposed to have Amelia Earhart appear at the end, because sometimes they would guess. So we were supposed to have Amelia Earhart appear, but she is behind schedule, and it looks like we won't be able to have her on until next week. Mm. And I went, Oh, no, you won't. Oh, no, you won't. She's gone. You know? Oh. I thought, oh, you know, awkward. You know?
Well, the movie that I am going to recommend, I often like to tie it in with the film we talk about, but I didn't manage to do that this time. I was kind of like, I'm running out of time. I need something here. So, Howard, you get the bonus points for tying it into the movie we talked about. I just decided to go with actually the last movie that I watched when I went to the movie theater today, and I quite enjoyed this one. I saw today Guy Ritchie's new film, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. So I'm going to recommend that one. It's, of course, based on a true story. It's about a unique team that is put together at the request of Winston Churchill to sabotage the resupplying operation for the German U-boats. The U-boats have basically been causing trouble, making it impossible for the Americans to aid the British, get them supplies, and join the war effort. So Churchill wants to take out the U-boats, so he assembles this team to go take care of that. And it's a film that's kind of, as I was thinking about it, I was like, all right, well, this is like part Dirty Dozen, part James Bond movie. And by the way, I should say Ian Fleming is a character in this film. So kind of combine those two things and then sprinkle in a little bit of like Looney Tunes cartoons. It's a kind of an odd mix, but I had a lot of fun with it. You've got Henry Cavill playing the leader of this ragtag group, and I thought he was really good. I mean, in general, I enjoy these type of movies where you've got a team of colorful characters put together to you know, do some kind of mission. So this was a lot of fun for me. It's a historical film, but at the same time, it's got this kind of heightened reality going on, which just makes it feel a bit off kilter, a bit odd, and I appreciated that. So just out in theaters here this weekend as we're recording it, and I'd recommend it.
Sounds good.
Well, Howard, I want to thank you for being on the show. Please take a moment here, remind everybody of where they can find you and your podcast.
I think the main three places is Apple. That's one of them. The other is Spotify and Podomatic, but Spotify and Podomatic are in many ways the same thing now, because I think Spotify bought Podomatic. But then there are other places you can also find it as well, smaller ones. But those are the main areas. If you go on my Facebook page, I'll have the listings. If you go on my blog, Rantings and Ravings, they'll also have the links to them as well.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read more reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. We welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. And I'd also like to mention some other recent podcasts that I've been a guest on. You can hear me on one of the most recent episodes of the Exploding Helicopter podcast, where we talked about the film Uncommon Valor, starring Gene Hackman. And I was also on a recent episode of Out Now with Aaron and Abe, where we talked about the new release, The Fall Guy. So be sure to check out both of those podcasts wherever you find great podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again real soon.
What do you think?
I understand Jim has a new set of dentures, too.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.